This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about animal therapy as a factor in mental health services. And we're focusing on one in particular that has a very distinct approach to this, whereby they're really the first in the world to have the specific combination of the types of animals they work with, the types of needs they serve in their community. And so it's a really fascinating perspective on an area of mental health support that I think will really grow. So if people aren't familiar with animal therapy, that term can mean so many things. Usually the commonalities are the animals have had some level of training in order to be supportive towards people. And that can be, you know, as specialized as working with a particular condition to very general. And it really just depends on what they're needed for. It can also mean a whole range of animals. And so I'll talk a little bit more about the distinct approach our guest is talking about in the interview. But first, we've got a few stats to sort of set the scene. And the first one is from the Department of Sociology at St. Leo University in Florida. And they found that trauma patients in particular have a much easier time with animal-assisted therapy. So animal-assisted therapy is where, in the simplest sense, an animal is involved in the therapy sessions. And so that can be anything from there just being there as a physical presence and being reassuring to somebody, or being at times a helpful distraction from what can otherwise be quite an intimidating scenario for a lot of people, right up to actually being a more obviously active part of the session. Obviously the animals have training that they are active, but, you know, be more obviously involved, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, actually, and the fact that we don't, because when we think about it, you're absolutely right. You know, therapy for some people can be quite daunting, and just having an animal in the room, like you said, can almost just really detract from what you're doing there. Even the little rabbit hopping around, or a dog. I mean, I know our guests, you know, they're on a ranch, aren't they, and they have horses, so I doubt we have a horse in a therapeutic setting in the room. But you could, because you could walk on a field, couldn't you, and have therapy while you're walking and talking and look at all the horses. So absolutely you could. But yeah, I think even without some of the deeper level stuff that I know you're going to talk about, just actually having a little animal in a room or near you would be quite comforting, I guess.
Yeah. And I think this is why it can be a little bit difficult to describe, because this can be just so broad. And so an example that is very common, you know, for a long time in the UK, is having fish in either therapists' offices or in like waiting rooms. Like, I grew up going to a dentist that had fish in the waiting room, and I asked about it, and it was very much like something to distract people. And then if they're nervous about being there and waiting for their dentist appointment, well, then there's fish there to look at, or, you know, get the kids to look at the fish rather than think about what could be a scary environment. So depending how broad you want to define this, it can include a lot of things that we're accustomed to seeing. And in particular, the Department of Sociology at that university in Florida that I've mentioned, they were looking at how domestic violence survivors often struggle to open up in traditional therapy. And so animals in therapy have shown a dramatic improvement in how comfortable people can feel speaking up about their issues. Also from those same stats, pet therapy statistics showed that abuse victims trust their therapist or counsellor much quickly with an animal present, especially if it's a dog. And they looked a little bit at why that might be. And many of those positives come from the dog's emotional intelligence. So they understand humans on a different level, knowing when to help and when to back away instinctively. And I think that's really incredible. And I think any of us that have pets, we see elements of that. You know, I think I've talked about on the show before, Milan, my cat, knows the difference between I'm staying in bed because I'm tired and I'm staying in bed because of depression. And she will behave differently accordingly,
in terms of like either leaving me alone or coming and sitting on the bed and keeping me company.
Yeah.
You know, I think that stuff can't be underestimated. And it's not just me that think that. So another stat I found was from WebMD that did a survey of pet owners, and 74% of them say that their mental health is improved by the company of their pets.
Oh, I think I can imagine that 100%, hands down. And I think what I found interesting then with what you're saying was when people felt more comfortable with the therapist if they had a pet, and you said that a lot of the findings were around the fact that pets are instinctive and kind of know when to respond. And I also think it could be a little element of the trust, because you used that word trust. I feel like I'd feel a bit trusting that somebody's a caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
If they had a pet, the way that they interacted with their pet, I think I could see that being quite reassuring. If a therapist had, you know, a cat or a dog in the room that they actually looked after and gave care to, you'd see a side perhaps as well of a therapist that you wouldn't necessarily see if they didn't have that.
Yeah, it's a whole combination of reasons why this works. And that's one of them. And a lot of them seem small, but can be really powerful. Just the great company that animals can be, and then being neutral in that space as well. You know, so in what could be an emotional room, the animal can often, you know, pick up on that and respond accordingly, particularly with training. But, you know, the dog's not going to start crying. Like, you know, it is one being in the room that is going to be kind of emotionally on a different plane. And it's difficult to describe how positive that can be other than experiencing it. And actually, our guest really talked about that he came from quite a traditional therapeutic background. And this approach of including animals in the therapeutic experience was kind of new to him. And it took a while, and really him experiencing the therapy for himself, to then be like, okay, now I get how much of a difference this can make. Whereas before, I think a part of him was like, oh, this is a nice idea, but how much difference does it make? And so I'm really glad to cover this topic, particularly, as I said, it's a growing area. Therapy and emotional support animals in the US alone now total more than 65,000. So way more than I even knew.
Wow.
Yeah. Although, maybe I should say for context, when you divide that down by the population, that's a little bit less than one animal per 5,000 people. So, you know, there's not going to be enough to go around yet, but still 65,000, obviously something is working.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great thing. We want to think about that more here. I think they used rescue animals at the ranch, right? Like, there's that many animals that are rescued, and what perhaps they could then help with and in turn get a lot of love back. And, you know, if we embrace this a little bit more over here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so, so for some background then, Ranch Hands Rescue is the organisation that our guest is part of. And I'll read a bit of the description about them. So they fill a special niche in mental health counselling services, in that they specialise in treating more complex trauma cases, such as victims of severe and repetitive abuse and people not making progress in their current treatment programmes. They heal critical care animals, then give them a purpose in counselling programmes as they participate in equine and animal-assisted counselling, which can be shortened to EAAC, alongside specifically selected licensed professional counsellors. So that's sort of the summary on what they do. So it's this combination of providing support to people, both that come in for sessions, and they also have a safe house more recently to support those who have gone through specifically human trafficking. So it's incredible work that they do. You'll hear in the episode, I'm so passionate about what they're doing and just getting my head around this distinct approach that they have, but also how animal therapies can just make such a difference.
Yes, that just sounds incredible. They've got a lot going on. No, they have. They're doing well there. They've got a lot going on at the ranch. How nice, though, when you've got that facility and that knowledge and, you know, the time, the motivation to want to do that and do something that's new and develop it further. And, you know, to hear you talk about, you mentioned, you know, some of the people that they have at the ranch who really have experienced some hardcore trauma. And imagine just being around like animals and on a ranch, and that be your just first kind of safe experience. Like that just feels really like heartwarming, that there's environments like that for people to just be able to just take a breath and feel safe and be outside, and, you know, that real safety thing. And then what the animals give, because they're just so loving and genuine. I just think it's amazing work that they're doing. I'm really pleased that we've had this guest on.
Yeah, for sure. It's fascinating to me. And I should say it is a very moving episode. I'm also going to put a link in the episode description to their website where you can watch a video that sums up their service, which I've watched it twice now, and it makes me well up both times just to hear how incredible the impact of their work is. And actually, our guest is one of the people featured in the video on the homepage. So do check out that as well. In the episode, we do talk about suicide right from fairly early on. And like we've mentioned, human trafficking as well. So, you know, there is a real depth and seriousness to the conversation, but also so much hope from the work that they do and the results that they see. And yeah, so moving. And also, not for nothing, it's a ranch in Texas, and listeners may remember Healing Springs Ranch. We talked to the founder of that previously, and that's an addiction service, which has a few parallels as well. So whatever's happening in Texas, there is a very impressive revolution of different services that are just filling, you know, otherwise quite major gaps, really, in healthcare, and doing it in a way that's innovative and just sounds so wonderful to be a part of.
Yes, absolutely. They're making the most of all that lovely space. And a friend of mine went to Texas up for work not long ago, and she said, honestly, it's just a different world. It's just what you see, like on TV, what you think it's going to be, you know. She's like, the cowboys, and it really was like ranchy. It felt so novel and exciting. And to think about, you know, this work being carried out in that kind of environment and down in the south, like, I'd love to go. We need to take a visit. Maybe our guest will invite us. Yeah, we can go to Texas for a bit. That'd be nice.
I'd love that. Yeah, let's do it. And so for now, we'll get into this episode with our guest, Landon Dickinson, who's the clinical director at Ranch Hands Rescue, does an incredible job and is so insightful on this topic. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name's Landon. My early experience with mental health is interesting, being someone who grew up in the South in America. So mental health is not something that was really addressed or talked about. I first started researching this stuff because of physical symptoms. So I got interested in the mind-body connection at an early age. And then as I got older, I'd really discovered that what I was dealing with was childhood trauma. And I just didn't realize what was causing the depression, the lack of sleep, the anxiety issues. Like, I just didn't really understand what was going on. And once I got a little older and started digging into it and started going to counseling, a lot of stuff came up and came out that was early childhood trauma. And so it was really a matter of working through that as an adult, which really sent me on about a 10-year journey of going through, you know, bouts of being suicidal, high anxiety, different medications, different therapies, you name it. Until, you know, I finally hit that place of recovery where I felt like a functional person. And it was a combination of the medication, mental health therapy, support from friends, and then developing healthy supports with my family and rebuilding those connections. And like I said, all of that took about 10 years. And for the last two of that, I've been completely sober as well. Last 2.5 now, completely sober, no alcohol, no cigarettes, nothing. It's been a long journey, but a really rewarding and valuable one. And I take the lessons that I learned from my own journey and, you know, infuse that into the practice that I have now, because on a certain level, I know what works and I know what doesn't work. And I know that it's not going to be the same for every person, but at the very least, if I can listen to what my body's saying and what my own journey is telling me, then it can help me tap into something for the person sitting across from me and modify it to fit, you know, their unique situation. So that's, in a nutshell, in a very short version, that's been my experience with my own mental health.
For sure. Well, thank you for sharing. And I'm interested in particular what you mentioned about gaining understanding of traumatic experiences you'd been through. So was that in terms of what happened was sort of normalized at the time? Was it that certain memories you had to kind of regain? Can you share a little bit more about what that meant?
Absolutely. Actually, a bit of both. You know, some of it was, you know, especially as I got to be an adult, it was, okay, why can't I remember large chunks of time? You know, like my memory really didn't begin until age like 14, 15. And that doesn't make sense. You know, most people's earliest memories are 2-3 years old. So like, why such a gap? So trying to discover and uncover what was going on there. And then also some things that I had normalized and internalized. So for example, one thing that's made me really good at my various jobs is I'm very observational. I'm really good at observing things. I notice little details very well. And I thought that was just a personality feature, you know, just a quality that I had. And then I got older and started researching and learning about trauma. And I'm like, oh, that's hypervigilance. I just internalized it as a quality of mine because it's been happening since I was so young. And so, you know, a lot of that's really transformed into me understanding how what we label as like personality disorders or anxiety, depression, it's really coping strategies, maladaptive coping strategies that we develop during key developmental periods of our childhood. And so uncovering, you know, who am I really separate from the trauma reactions? That's been a big part of that journey and trying to understand and unpack that. In addition to working through the traumas themselves that come up, some of which I still don't remember, but my body does, right? So even though I don't have the episodic memory to attach it to, I can still do the work through my body and through, you know, this what they call somatic experiencing. So it's been an interesting journey to try to understand those ins and outs.
For sure. And already I'm noticing a few similarities there with my own experience, particularly around memory, that it wasn't until, you know, only a few years ago through counselling, I even found out that one of the parts of depression can be these big gaps in your memory. And I simply didn't know that. Similarly, I just attributed it to, this is just something to do with me or my brain or something not related to what the contents of the memories were, basically. Right. And it is just so fascinating, but also quite, I think, scary when you explore your mental health and particularly delve into it in counselling, that there aren't easy answers for a lot of this stuff. You know, where you draw the line between what is who you are and what is the experiences you've had up to this point. Difficult to say if there is even a clear distinction there at all.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I agree. Dissociation is something I deal with a lot, both in my own work and then my work as a therapist, is understanding, you know, how dissociation impacts us, because we all experience it. I mean, deja vu is basically just a really mild form of dissociation. So we all experience dissociation on some level, but, you know, when it gets to such a level that you have amnesia or memory gaps or, you know, you lose time, that's getting a little bit more serious. And, you know, understanding not only how did that, like, where's the line between, okay, that was a coping strategy that my body kicked in to get through whatever that experience was, and now it's not functional anymore, versus, okay, that's a totally appropriate and reasonable reaction given what happened or what is happening right now. You know, like being able to understand where those lines are as an adult, it's almost like reparenting yourself in many ways, you know. And at least for me, that was a big breakthrough, actually, was kind of inner child work, you know, getting in touch with the scared little kid and just kind of giving them a hug and letting them know it's going to be okay. And it's like, I got you. That was a big, big breakthrough for my recovery, at least.
Yeah. And I think if people haven't delved into that kind of work, it can seem very far off and difficult to relate to even talking about inner child work. And I think I very much felt the same way before I kind of got to that within my own counselling sessions. And although it's been something to sort of wrap my head around. It's been so helpful because then I was able to start seeing all these times in my life where I'd had an emotional reaction that was so much stronger than the situation demanded and made me feel very out of control, really. And now I can understand more of those links of, okay, somebody made you feel this way and that triggered stuff to do with your history. And that's why you were more upset, because you were upset about the past stuff and what was happening right now. And so as much as it can be really difficult to wrap your head around, I'm so grateful to have explored that stuff, because now I can have that additional perspective and be like, oh, I can see that I'm reacting in a big way here. And that can be valid whilst also being disproportionate to this situation. And so maybe I take myself out of it. Maybe I engage in more self-care. Maybe I have a rest from whatever has brought this up and come back to it. Because otherwise, what's the default? You're sort of fighting your past in a situation which is not your past.
Right. Well said. No, I'm with you 100% on that. It's, you know, I think for me, at least a big part of that is I try to put myself in the shoes of my younger self, as well as my clients, when working through this stuff, whether it be working through my own stuff or working through their stuff with them, of like, if it's this challenging and this, like, if it takes this much mindfulness and this much attention and this much thoughtfulness and work and support to get through it as an adult with a, you know, fully developed neocortex, then that just gives me a tremendous amount of empathy for the little kid who didn't have a fully developed neocortex or the support or the understanding or the knowledge. Like, he clearly was doing the best he could with what he had. Like, you can't blame him for the poor reaction that he had, because that's all he knew at that moment in time. You know, he didn't have the benefit of what I have now. And so it makes me cry for that kid sometimes. But, you know, at the same time, it's kind of what he needs, is to know that somebody cares and that he's being heard and understood, and that it's okay that he had that reaction, or that he, you know, responded in that way. Because, again, at the time, he had no other tools at his disposal. And so to me, that's a great way to not only help my own recovery, but to destigmatize mental health as a whole, and especially for my clients, to kind of normalize things and go, no, it's not your fault. You did everything you could with what you had, and it's okay that you didn't know better at the time, or that you didn't have other options. You know, whatever you did technically worked because you're here now, right? So it's about forgiving that past self, or at least, you know, accepting that past self for how it handled things, or how he dealt with the situation. And that's a hard place. You're right. That's a hard place to come to. That takes a lot of awareness work. And at least until you get to that point, that awareness can be its own challenge.
Absolutely. But then I think for me anyway, the alternative that I saw was worse, because it might've been a lifetime of acting out of fear and living my life in that way for fear that I should no longer have, that I should be in a place to move beyond, and I have a stability now that no longer warrants that. And so are you going to hold back from taking risks in your life, going for what you really want to, because of fear you had as a child? You know, that was, for me, that was the kind of process of, this is going to be really tough, but it's necessary.
100% agree with you again. I'd rather go through that journey and get to this point than stay in that place of fear for the rest of my life, or, you know, to be quite honest, that place of death, because that was my alternative for a while. And I went through being suicidal for quite a while before I worked through that, and haven't had that kind of thought in many, many years. And I'm grateful for that time and that work that I've done to get to that point. But, you know, that's a very unpleasant, dark place to be, you know?
Of course, absolutely. And as you got your own support dealing with those past traumas, could you share a little bit of how you got into the work you do now?
Absolutely. So one of the places that the work that I've done with myself to my own recovery took me is to Lost Team, which is called Local Outreach to Suicide Survivors. So basically, we would go on scene to a suicide death, and we would provide support and resources to the friends and the family for up to a year after that suicide loss. And, you know, just being the kind of person that I am, I think I got a little too involved and wasn't really taking care of myself. And so ended up with some pretty severe kind of secondary trauma reactions because it brought up a lot of stuff and I wasn't taking proper care of myself. So basically, in the course of doing that work, I then found this job. And I was getting my licensed professional counselor license at the time. So I was looking for hours for specific to that. And I came out here and how do I put this? Ranch Hands Rescue is such a magical and unique space. I'm very neuroscience, like science-minded kind of guy because the work with the animals, it really is that. And it's amazing how quickly and effective it can be, or how quickly it can be effective, because I had been working here for a little while and I just started the animal assisted piece of it. I hadn't really fully understood it yet. And what I found was a lot of my intention was trying to make it work. Like I would go out there with the animals and try to do therapy, quote unquote, right? I would try to make the interaction do whatever it's supposed to do, quote unquote. And it wasn't getting me anywhere. And I would beat my head against the wall because I couldn't figure out what was going on. And then doing this other job, I had a pretty rough suicide scene that I went on. And I started having like hand tremors and, you know, couldn't sleep and my drinking got worse, those kinds of things. So anyway, one day I came out to the ranch and instead of like trying to do something, I just came out completely empty. Like I had no intention. I had no plan. I was just there. And one of our animals, Bluebonnet, she's a paint. And she has a injury to her front right leg that is healed and she's not in any pain, but it causes her to drag that leg. And so she gets a special boot so that she doesn't, you know, wear that hoof down and hurt herself further. But anyway, you know, an animal like that, especially in Texas, would normally be put down because they can't serve a function. But we don't do that. We keep them here and we provide a sanctuary for them and provide for their medical care. She walked up to me and just kind of looked me in the eye and nuzzled me, and she knew where I was. She could feel it. She could sense it. She was just fully present with me. And the tremors that had been going on for like a week, 2 weeks, just stopped in that moment of connection with her. And that's when it finally like clicked for me that the work with the animals is not about doing something. It's just about being present and being open to a connection. It's an open invitation to be here rather than there, right? It's an open invitation to attach and connect rather than push away and disconnect. It's an open invitation. That's really the best way I can say it. And when you do that, they know how to fill that space naturally. And especially these animals, because they've been through their own trauma, they've been through their own recovery, they just get it on a neurobiological level. And you know, for some, they would say a spiritual level that they just kind of get it. But at the end of the day, the key piece for me is it finally got me out of my own head. And I had the opportunity to feel recovery, not just know recovery. And that's really where me diving headfirst into this work started.
That's so fascinating and such an experience to have, because I think so often when we think about the ways in which animals can support people, it's in a very fixed way. You know, a lot of us will think of like guide dogs, for example, where they've got a specific role, they're very thoroughly trained to help one particular segment of the population. And it's interesting how this approach differs in almost the opposite way, where it's like, oh, we keep it really open and then the animals interact with you. And for want of a better way of saying it, are really great company, because you don't really need to teach an animal to be a good listener. They're not going to talk over you. You don't need to, you know, book an appointment with them. They've got all the time. They're not going anywhere. They're on the ranch. You know, there's all these things that, you know, I'm saying it in a sort of silly way, but these can be such valuable things when many of the service users you'll work with may have been knocked back by other support methods or found that they don't work, and that actually more peace and space and a sort of paired back interaction may suit them really well, particularly if they've gone through a lot of the most intense end of mental health support, which can in itself, I think, be quite triggering, although I understand the reasons why. But if a lot of your experience has been, okay, sit down in this room, someone's going to run you through a checklist of, are you suicidal? When were you last suicidal? When did you last plan something? You know, that can be incredibly triggering, even though I understand why with emergency support that is so necessary. And so it's interesting, this approach where you sort of, I guess, for maybe like let nature take its course a little bit. It's a very organic way of support.
Organic. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Absolutely. It's, you know, you really hit the nail on the head, because our whole approach here, again, is to fill gaps in community services. And so we never wanted to take away from the wonderful work being done by other organizations. And so our focus has become that 1 to 10% of the population that doesn't get better in other treatment programs. So to your point, they've been through the other programs. They've been through the acute care, the inpatient. They've been through outpatient residential. They've been through groups. They've been through, you know, you name it, and they've still not gotten better. And so our focus really is that 1 to 10% that needs a different or more alternative approach to mental health therapy. And that is absolutely where the animals come in, and it becomes a much more organic process of recovery. Because, you know, everybody said when Bob tried to start this, that you have to have healthy animals. They have to be trained from birth. And like you said, dogs. And it's like, no, that's genuinely not the case. It's some of the best healers in the world are people who themselves are broken or have been broken. The key is that you do your own work of recovery. You know, if you've been through trauma and then you do the work of recovery and are vigilant about that, then you can actually be one of the most, you know, powerful people in terms of helping others heal. It's part of why support groups are so effective for people. They're in many cases more effective than just, you know, your typical therapy session. And there's a good reason for that. And that's the connection piece that you're talking about, that organic letting nature take its course, two beings having a moment of genuine understanding and connection within the bounds of safety and feeling safe. And that's really where the healing happens, is that, you know, you have an opportunity to be vulnerable again and have a connection again while being safe. And if you don't have that emotionally corrective experience, you can only make it so far in terms of recovery. Because, you know, I'm an insight-based therapist, but this work has really taught me that insight and understanding only gets you so far, right? It can come a long way, but the totality of recovery doesn't happen until you feel it, until it gets internalized in your body. Then you can actually say that you've recovered from something, because you, and you know the difference. It's kind of like, you know, people talk about being in love, like you know it when you feel it. So it may be a thought process, it may be an understanding, but there's also a felt sense to it. And the animals tap into that felt sense piece so well that then it really opens the door for the counselor to then do that kind of top-down processing, right? The cognitive intellectual work, while the animals are doing kind of the bottom-up body work, and then it meets in the middle in the limbic system. So basically what you end up with is all clicking, and then you get congruence. And congruence is absolutely necessary for healing and recovery.
Yeah, I see what you're saying there. And what you remind me of is that huge gap between how easy it can be to give kind of mental health tips versus actually like implementing that and that being your life. You know, and I've certainly went a long time of knowing all the types of self-care, but that wasn't really helping me until I was applying it in meaningful ways at meaningful times, you know, and actually making that a part of my life, as opposed to a like getting to an emergency point of now I'm really overwhelmed, quick, what can I do? And instead, how can I preempt symptoms? How can I get in there early on? And it sounds like for many of the people that you work with, they're not able to access a lot of the big life changes that might be needed if they're still working on feeling safe around other people, for example. Yeah. And an yeah. animal can be a real bridge to that, where they aren't going to react to you in the way a person would. You can be quite angry and you can be stressed and you might be shouting and an animal's going to sit there and wait for you to calm down and then interact with you, you know, and people don't, you know, that's not what you would actually do.
The best part about that, you know, especially with the animals, is they're really great with boundaries and they don't store trauma in their bodies in the same way we do. They can, but what you notice with animals is that they discharge that survival energy really quick. So if somebody comes in and they're anxious or angry or, you know, worked up or something, and that survival energy is really high and activated, the animal will come up to them and then immediately walk away and go like, or shake, or you'll see them like twitch their muscles or something to get that energy out of their system because they're empathetic, you know, and they're picking up on it. But, you know, if you're really attentive, you can tell a client in that moment, you see what's happening there, they're picking up on your energy, but they're self-soothing. They're taking care of their physical and emotional needs right there in the moment so that it doesn't stay stuck in their system. And then seeing that interaction can be really powerful for people because it's kind of like, you know, people talk about the importance of neurofeedback and seeing in real time what's happening. Well, the animals do that. They show you exactly what's happening and exactly what you're doing, but they also show you what you need to do. And so, you know, it's not uncommon for me to tell my clients when they get worked up, you know, let that energy out if you need to. Let's go for a walk. Let's, you know, blow it out. You know, you don't need to just calm down and suppress it. You need to get it out sometimes. And the animals are a tremendous asset for learning how to self-soothe and not just do the, you know, the coping strategies that we all talk about, but to genuinely assess what your need is and address it at a core level. You know what I mean?
And it's funny, isn't it, just how organically they might do that. And yet, you know, as humans, we can't walk away from every situation that's stressful. An animal will just do that by default. Yeah. And sometimes we can be so into our kind of defense mechanisms that our own instincts have got reversed. So someone could be aggressive and confrontational to us, and the logical thing may be that kind of fight or flight response. And instead we freeze up and we try and make ourselves smaller and not aggravate the person more. And we can all imagine, you know, types of situations someone might have been in that would build up that kind of response in them. So could you share a little bit about the people you work with at the ranch?
As I mentioned before, our focus is that 1 to 10% of people who've not gotten better in other programs. So oftentimes what that means is we're dealing with complex trauma, complex PTSD, which means multiple instances of trauma over a period of time. So that's in many cases going to include early sexual abuse, early childhood sexual, physical, emotional abuse, neglect, people who've been abused by multiple perpetrators over the course of several years. For some, it's family members. And then for others, it's foster care, you know, and they've been through the system for many, many years. And, you know, they've been passed from house to house and various instances of trauma have occurred to them at each location. And, you know, then you start getting into those in adolescence or early adulthood, where because they've been through those experiences and that's become kind of normalized in terms of that's the expectation of life, they have increased vulnerability for other traumas and for traumas outside of the immediate family system or the immediate social system. And so an area that we've kind of broken into in recent years, just by function of focusing on that population, is sex trafficking, both girls and boys. And, you know, it turns out that up to 50% of sex trafficked youth are boys. And a lot of people don't realize that. They just think women and girls. But, you know, we're seeing that a lot in our program is complex trauma, personality disorders, a variety of diagnoses and different treatment attempts. Like I said, severe issues like sex trafficking or, you know, severe self-harm, eating disorders, suicide, you name it. Because when you've had all of that and you've been through other programs and not gotten better, things just get worse. You know, time doesn't heal all wounds. Time just gives us the opportunity to heal those wounds. We have to then do the work, right? And so the kind of cross-section of individuals we serve are those who, again, have been through multiple traumas. They are typically low income, and so they're on scholarship in most cases, which means, you know, we subsidize the cost of their counseling sessions through donation funds that we receive. We also have, I guess you could say, our animals as clients. And the majority of those that are in the sanctuary, they were law enforcement seizure. So they've been through their own abuse, neglect, severe trauma histories that they have to, you know, work through and recover from. And then that's where you get the people helping animals, animals helping people, because it becomes a feedback loop and a reciprocation of love and support. So I guess in a nutshell, the short version would be we work with trauma.
Yeah. And I love that idea of the kind of feedback loop of looking after the animals in return. I think that's so important. And so in particular, I just wanted to ask about the sex trafficking victims that you work with, because I know it's something that can be very underserved in terms of support, both within, you know, mental health, but also other kinds of support like law enforcement and justice through the courts, etc. And you mentioned there about the misconceptions on gender. And we often try and tackle that through our own show, particularly how so often with mental health, people can assume that certain illnesses affect only one gender or a different gender. That's something that I think is really important to tackle. So do you find then plays into part of the reason why these communities are underserved? So there's an underserving of resources and what's out there, but then also potentially certain resources discriminating against people based on gender, or not being accessible, or not being broad enough in the support that they give for people of all gender.
Yeah. Honestly, all of those things you said and more. I mean, it's such a big topic and such a big challenge. I put together an executive summary of the gaps that we've noticed, because the two people or the two groups that are the highest risk and the most underserved are transgender youth and youth with autism and or IDD, which is, you know, intellectual and developmental disability. There are no homes, no houses, no placements for those groups. The ones that do exist, like for transgender youth, pretty much make them identify as their biological sex, which is just an added trauma. It's an added, you know, wrinkle to what they're already dealing with. And then the autism IDD, there are no homes for them, especially that overlap with the trauma piece. So you get, you know, opportunities to assess for the autism or the IDD, but not taking into account the trauma. It's like one or the other. There's no overlap. And, you know, at Bob's House of Hope, we actually have both in there because there's nowhere for these people to go. And we're one of the only gender affirming programs in the whole country as well, because that's the right thing to do. It shouldn't even be a question, in my opinion, because the focus is the trauma. Like, I don't know what these other programs are doing in that, by thinking that it's okay to discriminate in that way. I could get on a soapbox about that. But the bottom line here being that when you think about it like this, when you are a minority in America, when you have been through the system already and multiple different treatment programs, and then especially when you have been discriminated against for all of those things, your low income status, your minority status, the color of your skin, and then now you tack on top of it gender dysphoria and the way you're being treated for those things. I mean, those are traumas in and of themselves. And that just reinforces and increases the risk for victimization in the world of sex trafficking, because it's vulnerabilities. Same with autism IDD, it's vulnerabilities. And that's what perpetrators prey on, is vulnerabilities. And so if you have this history of pre-existing vulnerabilities, and then you think, hey, this is a way I can make some money and get out of this house where I'm being mistreated like this, especially if you've been sexually abused and you're like, oh, well, at least I can make money doing it now. And you get out, and then the next thing you know, it's way worse than what you expected. And that's what we see time and time again with these youth, is that at least at first it sounds great because it's a way to get money. And, you know, you don't care because you've already been through that. And the message that the traumas have sent you is that you're worthless, or that you don't matter. And when that message is what's looping in your head, it just makes you that much easier to manipulate and to take advantage of. And then over the course of, you know, that initial grooming phase, people get roped in and sucked into this world. And then the next thing you know, they're, you know, being drugged up, and, you know, it's 15 hours on loop. So basically they give them, you know, the trafficker will give them 15 hours worth of drugs, so that then they have to come back at the end of a quote-unquote shift right? After they've, you know, sold to however many guys or gals, and then you have to go back to get your fix, right? Because you're hooked on the drug and you don't have a choice. In fact, something that really infuriated me is we performed an extraction on a young man out of Austin. And first thing that happened is we got into a hospital. They didn't know how to do a rape kit on a male. So nothing we could do there, even though he was willing and wanted to, you know, be able to make the report. And then after that, we got him extracted further from out of that town and into another town. And we were trying to find treatment options for him because he was detoxing. And one treatment center turned us away saying that because he didn't choose to take the drugs, it didn't count. He didn't qualify. Like, are you kidding me? Because somebody else forced him to take them? That means he's not addicted? Or what are you saying?
Well, that's so, it. Yeah. It doesn't change the process of detox of the drugs coming out of your system, how they got in there.
Right. Yeah, it boggles my mind, the layers of gaps. Some of them are nuanced gaps where it's like, okay, I can see how the system would struggle to fit that exact issue and take care of it. Okay, fair. I get that. But then there's ones like that one where I'm like, what are we doing? What are we thinking that that's an acceptable answer? It blows my mind sometimes.
Yeah, particularly, you know, within services that should know better. You know, I can understand within the broader community, there is a lack of understanding of how broad sex trafficking can be. I think if you ask most people on the street, they would think of it in terms of moving people across borders,
right,
between countries. You know, they wouldn't even think of necessarily borders within the States, for example. And then also you've talked about examples of how people can be a repeat victim as well. And particularly if the services aren't there, well, then if you're not getting support to change your life in other ways, well, then the same people may come knocking and come back to you. So, you know, I can see how dangerous these cycles can be. And so when you take on new people into your services, where do those referrals initially come from?
So for us, at the Safe House at least, it's been a combination of advocacy agencies. So, you know, people that are making contact with them while they're still on the streets and just building the relationship that way. And then it's also come from other treatment providers who have, you know, performed the extraction and then don't have a place for them because there isn't one. And then the last is law enforcement. And it's more or less the same on the outpatient counseling side. It's just that the additional piece on the outpatient counseling is a good foster placement. So like, you know, a family or a home that does care and that is trying their best, that has gotten them out of that environment and is now trying to get them help for their trauma, or another safe house, you know, especially like for females, because we have several safe houses for females in the area, and some of them refer their residents to us for counseling services.
Right. And so if we take that as an example then, so someone that's receiving housing and other kinds of support like that externally, but coming into you as an outpatient, is there a typical sort of treatment they'd get in terms of length, in terms of amount of sessions, amount of time with the mental health professionals, with the animals?
That's a great question. And that's actually another one of the gaps, is that a lot of treatment programs are managed care, which means insurance based. And so it's time limited. So they get 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, or they get a certain number of sessions. And that doesn't work for this population. It just plain and simple. 3 months is not enough. So a lot of times the individuals that we're seeing in our outpatient program that have been through that level of trauma, we're looking at 2 to 3 years. So for some, 18 months, if all other things being equal and they have the proper support and, you know, they've made it to a certain level of recovery, then they're ready to do the true trauma work, great. That's probably going to be about 18 months. But if you're looking at somebody who just got out and doesn't even realize the extent of their trauma or, you know, what all they really need, then you're looking at 2 to 3 years, in some cases 4, but that's a whole lot shorter than the 10 to 20 years of treatment hopping that you see for those who don't get access to care. Because that's what happens to a lot of people, you know, especially young adults before they come to us. They've usually been in and out of programs for the last decade and not gotten any better. But it's imperative that we change that narrative in terms of mental health recovery, because when you're dealing with that level of trauma, it's going to take a few years, but it has to be a few years consistently. It can't just be hopping from program to program. You need that consistency in that single safe space to really do the work of recovery. And even our safe house program, Bob's House of Hope, that's a 3-year program. So these young men can stay with us for up to 3 years before we help them with transitioning out to a longer term option. But ideally at the end of 3 years, they are in a place of recovery where they can do their own outpatient work. They have money in the bank, they have their own car, a job, place to live, all the basic needs handled already. So I guess in a nutshell, what I really want to say there is that we need to create space for 2 to 3 years when it comes to recovery from complex trauma.
And particularly when working with groups that have not known safety for so much of their lives. I think that's incredible to be able to do that long-term work, to have the facilities available to you that you can create a safety somebody might have never known. You know, that is one of the things that's so moving about this. And I think all of us get, little samples of this in our life, whether it's like our own pets that bring us such comfort and such company, and our friends that we offload to. And luckily there are plenty of people out there that that's enough for. And if it's not, there are other supports out there. But there are these populations that you describe that need so much more than that. And as distinctive as what your programs offer is, I think all of us can relate to parts of how much of a difference this would make, how much it can transform your life. Because I know, just being a pet owner, how big a factor Milan is in my life. So I'm never going to underestimate what an animal can do in a therapeutic setting. I'm not going to underestimate what counsellors can do going to my own counsellor for 3 years and seeing how that's changed my life. One last thing I wanted to start wrapping up with then was, am I right in remembering that you also work with veterans as well?
Yes. One of the populations that we're really passionate about working with as well is veterans. Not only have they all experienced trauma from the result of, being in the military, particularly at war, but a lot of people that go into the military go in to escape a traumatic childhood or traumatic adolescence. And there's a variety of additional traumas that you're stacking on, either whether you're assaulted in the military or you end up in a war zone or whatever it is, that unfortunately just packed trauma on top of trauma. And when you have that kind of situation, once again, you're dealing with somebody who now has complex PTSD, and your traditional approaches aren't going to cut it. They're just not going to be enough to get them to that place of recovery that they need.
And so what sort of impact do you see of your distinct approaches for that population?
They've been very, very receptive. Veterans in general kind of get a bad rap for being treatment resistant, not because of their, specific mental health concerns, but because of kind of that machismo attitude around talking about your feelings and getting help and that sort of thing. And so the ability to work with the animals really helps break down those walls, those barriers, that stigma. And, one of the things that really does get through to people who are resistant, whether it be a veteran or, a teenager with oppositional defiant disorder or what have you, is the idea that their presence, their work is actually helping the animal heal too. Because that's absolutely true. It's not just a tactic, that's an actual truth. One of the animals that I've helped recover, her name is Starlight. She's a sheep and she has tremendous medical trauma from an injury that was not able to be fixed, but we take care of it every day and she's doing good. But when she first came to us, she had been handled and mishandled so much that she would just, hide in the corner. She wouldn't have anything to do with any person. She was terrified of people. But it was working with her and one of my clients, a highly resistant client, and working with them together that actually helped both her and him in their recovery. And both of them got to a place of being able to open up and reconnect. And it's an amazing thing to be able to watch these people that come in that are like, this isn't going to work, I hate this. I've been to the VA. I've been to this. I've been to that. Nothing works. And then spend some time with the animals and do that consistently and establish that sense of not only external safety, but also internal felt safety. And then the light bulb comes on and the recovery work really starts. And to see that happen for both the animal and the person is just really, really cool.
For sure. And a final follow-up question then to that is, I do see that understanding around therapy animals is increasing, and there are more services launching here in the UK. There are more ways in which animals are being brought into existing services as well. So what do you see the future of that being? Would we one day get to a world where it's very common to be able to choose a therapist local to you that works with an animal in their sessions?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I keep saying that I would really love to see a ranch hands rescue in every state. And that's kind of like a career goal for me, is to really expand this model and to make it sustainable and effective across a wide range of locations. But I also don't see why we can't expand this model into other species. So, you know, whenever we started this, everybody said, nope, it's got to be healthy animals and it's got to be horses or dogs. That's it. And it's like, turns out that's not true. Sheep, goats, you know, alpacas, llamas. Llamas are great with kiddos with autism. I don't know why, but they are. There's, you know, you name it. We've had success in working with the different species. So, I mean, I'd love to see, you know, I don't know, exotic hands rescue, where it's therapy with elephants. You know, like, they're really smart. They're empathetic. Why not? They need rescuing. They need sanctuary. Why not make it happen? So I do see this growing. This trend is growing, and there's increasing awareness. So I'm hopeful. The only real barrier I see to it is cost. It is very expensive to care for these animals, especially special needs animals, because their medical bills can be $5,000 or more. And then also the training that it takes to get to this level. You know, I mean, we all go through EMDR, TBRI, TFCBT, DBT, animal assisted. Like, there's a lot of professional growth and development and training that goes into it. So cost would be the only barrier. But if people can get past that in their head and recognize that an upfront cost yields a lower long-term cost, then I think we might actually see this happen more and more, which would be exciting.
Yeah. I'm going to ask my counselor about it. Be like, have you ever considered having a dog? I love dogs.
Yeah, they should do it. Absolutely.
Yeah, but I've certainly known anecdotally through friends of mine that work in mental health services that they've seen such incredible impact when bringing animals into like secure wards and other kind of inpatient clinics as well. So even just the impact of it is often dogs, a dog coming in for an afternoon, and how that can just change the mood on a ward so dramatically is really exciting. So thank you so much for sharing and all the brilliant work you do. If people want to find out more about it, where should they go?
They can go to ranchhandsrescue.org. We'll also be rolling out bobshouseofhope.org very soon. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and we're building our LinkedIn page, because that's a big up and coming thing that we need to develop. So any of the social media handles, and then like I said, ranchhandsrescue.org. You can also reach me directly if you have questions at landon@ranchhandrescue.org, and just follow us on social media, like I said.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks, Bobby.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.